Hi everyone, I'm Sarah and this is How to Be Good, the podcast that explores what it means to be a good person in today's world. Today I'm talking with Hindu Pandita Indrani Rampasad.
We are not born sinners. We are divinity incarnated in this body. And the purpose of life is to manifest that divinity.
Dr. Pandita Indrani is a Trinidadian Indian Hindu, researcher and women's activist who in 2013 received Trinidad and Tobago's National Award Gold for her outstanding contribution to the development of women's rights and issues. She is also the first ever official female priest to be ordained in Trinidad. The word Pandita means priest or something more close to reverend.
There was resistance to women taking up this leadership role. And I was like, but you know, my intellect, my knowledge, I am like equal to you and better than many. So why would I not be accepted?
In her professional life, Pandita Indrani has worked as a teacher in Trinidad and New York, as well as a senior journalist. She holds her PhD in communication and journalism and continues to work tirelessly to encourage women and girls to derive empowerment from their spiritual identity. Above all, Pandita Indrani is a peace advocate who propagates mutual respect as a necessity for harmonious living, and she sees cultural identity as a human right. I loved learning more about Hinduism from Pandita Indrani. She combines sharp intellect with such a playful spirit, and I really hope you enjoy this conversation. It brings me huge joy to introduce you all to Dr. Pandita Indrani Rampasad.
So namaste, and in the tradition of my ancestors, we also say Ram Ram and Sita Ram. My ancestors in the Caribbean, you know, we've come from India in colonial times. The first Indians that came here in Trinidad were like 1845, in Guyana, 1838, and so on. So it's around that time under British rule in India. My ancestors came mostly from North India, some from South, but the tradition was largely informed by the Ramayana, the Ramcharitmanas. The Ramayana is written by Tulsidas. And that was written for the layman, the common person. So it was very popular. So our values and our way of life is largely informed by that text. That's why they say Ram Ram. So I greet you in the name of Ram, as it were. Sita Ram, I greet you in the name of Sita and Ram, Sita being the spouse of Ram.
Well, thank you. And Sita Ram. Now, although it's the third largest religion in the world, many of us outside of India won't know too many details about Hinduism as a belief system, because the majority of Hindus, I think over 90%, are based in India. So I thought it'd be a good idea if you could start us off by giving us a grounding in Hinduism so that we can start this conversation with an awareness of that, the kind of core belief system.
Traditionally, Hinduism is called Sanatan Dharma. Properly, it's called Sanatan Dharma, meaning that dharma which is everlasting, which is eternal. It's a way of life. It's just, for example, let's say you had gravitation. Gravity will not die or go away. It's always going to be there. So Sanatan Dharma is like those values that are always there. And so you will find it difficult. We are not a tradition of, say, going by any one book. In fact, we have a library of books. So we have revelation in the beginning through the what we call the Shruti, with the first revelation given to the rishis at the dawn of creation. And then we have human beings interpreting that revelation to suit the times as you go on. So the whole thing, it's about dharma, that which upkeeps. So like society, what is the dharma that upkeeps a society? You have your personal dharma. What is the dharma, the rules and the conduct that upkeep you as a human being? Your family dharma, what is it that upkeeps your family? So you can go like that in circles, going out from yourself to family, to society, to the globe. And that's why you will find in India, women hugging trees and refusing to allow people to cut them because they see life in the tree. There's an interconnectedness of life that informs Sanatan Dharma. It's the main thing, and that's why nonviolence is so important to us, because we see the creator, that Satchit Ananda, that pure consciousness, that pure existence, that pure bliss. The interdependence, we recognize all human life and all living things, animals and plants, even the plants, that there is life. You know, I remember my mother before worship would pick the flowers and they would ask permission first before plucking the flowers to use as part of worship. So they have practices that connect them with their cosmic reality. Now that cosmic reality, that connection is not explained in "you shall not steal," "you shall not do this," or "you shall do this." It's not like commands only. Yes, we have those, but it goes more than that. It's an aesthetic way of knowing your reality. And pain and suffering, we should seek not to impose on another in the process, especially in the sphere of religion. And Sanatan Dharma, we don't like the word religion because, again, it connotes a set of rules and regulations and a book, whereas our tradition is not like that. Yes, there are rules and regulations, and they go according to your stage in life. Life has been conceptualized in four stages. And generally, let's break up 100 years. We were supposed to live for 100 years or more. So up to 25, we're supposed to be in the stage of celibacy and education. Focus totally on that. 25 to the next quarter, 50, family life. And then 50, so then we have the vanaprastha, where the householder gives up the home to the, in those days, it would have been the patriarchal kind of setting, to the eldest son who would continue the tradition. You know, they had a whole structure where the joint family existed. It was not the nuclear family. So it was the joint family where the head of the family, the eldest son, would undertake to take care of the whole family. So we have the four stages of life, and the dharma, the code of conduct, differs. Of course, there's an overlap across, but they differ. What is my duty as a student to the parent? We have Matru Devo Bhava, Pitri Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava. Treat the mother and the father and the teacher as a devata. English, they would say God, but not that God. As a devata, meaning a person of great, who is somebody to be revered and worshipped, right? But not as God, but as somebody in the place of God. You know, we always make a joke, God couldn't come down here to take care of all of us, so he sent mothers. There is always that joke in our community.
So it sounds as if rituals are really important with Hinduism, and there's this priority on it being passed through families. But without the family, are there other ways that this dharma, this code of conduct, is communicated through the community?
We had rituals and we had stories. We have a rich tradition of storytelling. Very rich, that sometimes Christian missionaries have done great damage to it by interpreting literally. Now, we who have received the tradition, we understand what certain things mean. And somebody outside of the tradition interpreting literally does great damage, because you are not interpreting the symbols and the deeper meanings behind it and the connection between you, the Atman, and the source of life, the giver of life that we call God. I'm using that in a limited way. Right, that we say God, that Satchitananda. So that connection between the two is the purpose of life. And how do we get there? It's like, okay, now today in the world, we are all fighting. One religion says, okay, I'm going to take the bus to God. One says, I'm going to take my car. The next, I'm going to take a bicycle. And Hindus say, whichever way you go, just get there. Just focus on that and get there. So the strategy then for getting there is determined between you and the parent and the guru, the acharya, the teacher, the guru, the one who is like your spiritual guide. We are taught as pundits in the Caribbean. The pundit here does the rituals and just about all the leadership roles in the religious community. And we are taught very early to identify the swadharma of a person, meaning your innate nature. We are not all equal. We are not all zero, and then we're going to become, you know, into this great, fantastic thing. We are all different makeup. Mother has all children. The children are not all the same. She gives the same love, nurtures in the same way. They are not all the same. And they turn out. So we know that there are differences in the nature of the person. So obviously the pathway to God, to that union, is going to be different. So someone might say, you know, bhakti yoga, I like a lot of love and singing and serving community and reaching out. I'm that kind of person. So the guru or the mother will guide in that direction. Now, these are not separate parts. Bhakti yoga, karma yoga, gyan yoga. Gyan yoga is knowledge. Some of us are more into, like, you know, reading the scriptures and the texts and getting to know. And karma yoga, performing good actions. They are not separate. They are intertwined. But of course, one is going to shine more in your life as per your nature. So that is determined by the guru helping you and then advising you with which text to read, which rituals to perform, and how to move along.
So can you tell us a little bit more about these stations of life and really how that connects to this idea of how to be a good person within the teachings of Hinduism?
Well, in terms of good, I use the word dharma. Dharma means that righteousness. It means that code of conduct as per your station in life, as per your situation. What's it about being good? I won't recommend killing anybody, shooting anybody as a normal course of living. However, if you were in the army and you had to do that, that is, acceptable. So being good has to do with, again, your station in life. And that's not black and white. One thing you understand about Hinduism, it's Hinduism, Sanatan Dharma. It's not polarities. We have great difficulty telling you polarities. Because, yes, we live in a world of polarities, black and white, good and bad, dharma and adharma. These are the two terms we use. Dharma, following that righteous path, adharma, that which does not promote the good of all. So dharma is meant to upkeep the different institutions, take the earth. Why we say rivers are sacred and we protect the trees and we have all kinds of stories and mythologies around them, sacred waters and sacred this and sacred that, because you see the connection with this sacredness of creation and you being a part of that creation, the interconnectedness. Once you break that, that is adharma, that is being bad. That is not being good. I don't like using those two words, but I mean, it's like you are threatening the very existence of the institution. You're threatening the very existence of Earth when we engage in a lot of these pollution, this kind of lifestyle. So that is being bad.
I appreciate when you say not wanting to use the terms good and bad. We definitely ask these questions and oversimplify them just to get to some of these deep-rooted answers. But how would you advise someone if they really wanted to contribute positively to the world, what would you, which way would you steer them? What advice would you give them?
Don't hurt people in your thought, word, and deed. Why? Because the other person is also a manifestation of the creator of that divinity. So who are you hurting? You are actually, again, the divinity is resident in that person in all life. Try not to hurt. That is being bad. But remember I said in we have apad dharma, meaning dharma for special circumstances. As I explained to you, war was one of those. And the kind of foods you eat, we say, be nonviolent. That's why Hindus go the way of preferring a vegetarian lifestyle, because it's the least violent. Still plucking a tree and so on is life, but it's the least violent of all. Our texts, like the Mahabharata, for example, is full of these examples where they're between two, you have to choose the right path between two. And it's very, very difficult because you have so many variables to weigh. And it forces you to think broadly and think of all conditions. And there's no easy way out. And you still realize that you still have the concept of karma. Never forget karma in being bad and good. We know we have a bank. Okay, we put the bank, all of our good deeds go in there, and the adharma goes there. So we know our purpose is not to be reincarnated. Our purpose is not to come back in this continuous cycle of birth and death, pain and suffering. This is where pain and suffering lies, in this creation on earth. So we don't want to come back in that. It is to transcend that. You know, the purpose is to reduce all the bad karma, negative karma, which will be bad, and build up all the good karma, which is good.
I'm curious about the concept of forgiveness within Hinduism, especially related or linked to karma. So if you've maybe collected bad karma, but then feel very sorry, can you be forgiven within Hinduism? So does forgiveness have an effect, or does it impact karma in some way?
There is forgiveness. Say, for example, Yama, we say Yama, the Lord of Death. We've given death a name like Yama, the Lord of Death. You can beg how much you want. He's going to come, right? He's going to come. So similarly, your action bears fruit. And how do, if it's a bad thing and you are really sorry and you pray and, you know, this is, you surrender to God in that way, I think there is forgiveness, but you still have to deal with your karma. Otherwise, that God would be playing favorites. It would be like a shopkeeper. I'm going to give you so many dollars of prayers and forgive me. You know, so the karma concept, you still got to deal with it. But when you pray and your mind, your intellect, the whole, your being becomes, you surrender, you yourself will reap the bliss of that unity. The purpose is unity between my Atman and that, what we call Param Atman, what you say, God. My Atman and that, we are one. We are one and the same, but we don't recognize it in this world.
You mentioned about thought, will, and deed. And how does the balance between intention and action work within Hinduism?
Beautiful. The Bhagavad Gita tells you that so wonderfully. And it says, if you do an action, the intent behind that action is what causes the fruit. You will get that fruit. The karma is dependent on your intent behind the action. So I kill you in war. My intent was not to kill you, the human being. My intent was to defend my country. It was my duty. It was an honorable thing that I was doing. And I therefore accrue no negative karma. But if I just took a gun out and shot you out on the street, that is, if out of envy, if it out of my personal the desire, anger, attachment, and so on, that leads to the fall of the Atman, the fall of the soul. Well, soul is not a proper explanation of Atman, but Atman is me, that divinity that I am in this body.
As a Hindu, is it a continuing learning process? It's a religion where it's adapting and growing and transforming quite a lot of the time.
Well, it's adapting to suit the circumstances that you are in. And that's why the guru or the acharya is so important. So we have books that guide us. We have teachings. We have teachers. And you have conscience. Conscience. We equate that conscience with that creator, that giver of life, that God that is seated within our hearts. So that God is in here. You don't have to look outside for the God. It's in your heart. So you come inwards.
Have you ever personally, as a pandita and also as an activist, have you ever found that the Hindu ideas of what it means to be a good person and your personal ideas have ever been in conflict?
For us, there was resistance to women taking up this leadership role. And it had to do like with menstruation and ritual purity and so on. Because when you're those who are into like performing lots of rites and rituals, it carries around it a sense of purity. There's a lot you have to prepare yourself before you conduct those rituals. So that's where women were considered like not ritually pure enough to take up the role. And I was like, but you know, my intellect, my knowledge, I am like equal to you and better than many. So why would I not be accepted? So I fought that battle. And even in India, it is one that you see, but it's also one alongside you see women, priests as well, panditas. In fact, in Pune, there's a school that trains them. And lots of them have been out in Europe and so on. So that change has been happening. And remember in India too, they have different titles. So while I might be Pandita here, you may have a Swami there. You may have a Sadhu there, Sadhvi. Different titles. And you got lots of women in that kind of role. I think it's in the ritual role, the ritual performance, that there's the more resistance. Of we have broken that in Trinidad. By and large, yes, we have broken that. But I'm not saying it's totally accepted by everybody, but there is growing acceptance.
Did any of the opposition you've ever come up against, have you ever had any personal doubts about whether what you're doing was the right thing or the good thing? Have you had any of those moments across your journey where you've had that self-doubt at any point?
No, not in terms of whether it was right or wrong to do it. I never had a doubt because I kind of sorted that out long before. But there was no doubt at all, no.
When I was carrying out my research for this interview, I came across the term Hindu phobia multiple times, and it's not a term that I'm that familiar with. I haven't seen it that often. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit to that and, you know, the research that you carry out around the Hindu religion. And maybe I'm really curious as to how Hindus are treated around the world.
Well, the word phobia, when you use it, Hindu phobia, Islamophobia, it's a fear of somebody. Nobody is afraid of the Hindu. We don't pick up guns to shoot. We don't kill you out of honor, that sort of thing. Nobody's afraid. There is hate. Hindu dvesha. So recently we've been using the word dvesha, Hindu dvesha. D-V-E-S-H-A. And we do have webinars around the Hindu Dvesha in America in particular. And people have been studying it. And of course, we have got to make people understand. First of all, did you know you're causing me pain and suffering when you did this, when you said this? And a lot of times we don't understand. And Hindus do not normally talk back, be it from India to here. It's colonial history. So there's a kind of decolonization that's taking place now through education. And we don't want to come back with anger. We are not asking for reparation. We are saying, let's forgive, let's understand, accept, forgive, and move on. You know, we're going to say, okay, that's the past. The Hindus are saying, but own it. Own what you have done. The Dvesha, the whole colonial thing of how India and Hindus were represented in the literature of colonization is terrible. We have been painted as lazy, as you know. I mean, we are more aware of what they have said about African slavery. A lot of negative things were said about the Africans. And the same thing was done to the Indians. And so the Indian was seen as a childish person. Even from the way you prayed, you know, they said you were praying with a childish mind. When they saw the murtis that the people were using to reach, to connect between their level of the mundane with the cosmic, their connection with the mundane to the cosmic, they couldn't understand that. That was not part of their world, of their paradigm. And so they looked at the Hindus as childish people. Look at the intelligence. Look at what Hindus have given to the world in terms of, you know, science and technology and this whole philosophy and the cosmic relationship. Now the world is talking about reality. We've always said there are different realities.
The time goes so quickly, and I'd really like to ask if there's one thing for our listeners, if one bit of advice you could give, if they wanted to go out and do something good in the world, you know, just a day-to-day thing, what would you think would be your key message you'd say into how to positively contribute to the world, and especially with that thread of how everything is interconnected and, you know, from that Hinduist perspective?
You know what, recently I has been coming to my mind when we look at the post-colonial kind of things that are happening with us around the world, and the racism and the misunderstandings and so on. People are adjusting. And lately I've been thinking, let's look at the other person. Don't see color. Don't see what you think is beauty, or don't see age. Look for the divinity in that person. Look for that piece of divinity that is that person, who also, like you, has hopes and dreams. And also we are here together and trying to make that flower. Could we look at that and go past the identity that is not lasting? The body and so on, the color and all that will go away. The language, the country, national, that will go away. But what is lasting is that divinity that is really you. And I'm saying, I wish we could all, when we look at somebody, see that first and perhaps last. That's what I'm thinking. And maybe we'll make the world a better place.
Pandita Indrani, thank you so much for joining me. Before we go, is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to talk about, or any final words you'd like to share with us?
We are not born sinners. We are divinity incarnated in this body. And the purpose of life is to manifest that divinity.
My hugest thanks go to Pandita Indrani for taking the time to talk with me, especially as she was in the midst of some intense research work. If after listening to that conversation, you'd like to learn more about the Pandita, then you can find her on Facebook, and I'll also add links to a couple of articles and previous interviews with her in the show description.
Thank you for having me, Sira. It was a pleasure. Namaste.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to hear more episodes and interviews exploring the question of what it means to be a good person in today's world, then please consider hitting the subscribe button. And if you have time and liked what you heard, then I would love you to leave a review and share with your friends. Thank you for listening. And if you have any questions or suggestions, please email me at any time. It's sarah@howtobegood.co.uk, and I would love to hear from you. Thank you.